Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. Coming up on today's podcast, we have an interview with playwright Claudia Allen. She will be talking to Ann Nicholson Weber in a one-on-one in-depth interview, and you don't want to miss this. Also, we have another audio review for you, and of course, Chicago's theater news. So sit back and relax, and get ready to talk theater.
You're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm your host this week, Ann Nicholson Weber. And today I'm going to be talking to Claudia Allen, who is a playwright and the adapter of the current production just opening at Victory Gardens of I Sailed with Magellan, an adaptation of the novel by Stuart Dybek. And Claudia has been associated with Victory Gardens for over 20 years. She's had 11 productions with the company, and she's a playwright in residence. Thanks so much for being here, Claudia.
Well, thanks for having me, Ann.
I think what's most interesting for me to talk about is the process of adapting someone else's work. What is different in doing an adaptation as compared to doing something original? But maybe the place to start is where did that come from, the idea of adapting this particular novel?
Well, I fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. I just started reading it, and within the first story just thought, oh my gosh, I would just love to see this on stage. And then was crazy enough to decide I should do it.
Uh-huh.
I thought, well, this is going to happen. And I knew Stuart a little bit, and I knew Stuart and our artistic director were friends. So once I had that idea, it did seem like it had some real potential. And it's such a big Chicago story. I also knew that we wanted big Chicago stories for our new space. And it just seemed like it was meant to be.
It would fit the bill.
Though I wasn't an expert at adapting, so it's been a pretty exhaustive learning experience for me.
Well, I would think that for someone who hasn't done a lot of adapting, choosing as your first project a book that's in the first person has, what, how many characters? Scores, right?
Many, many, many.
No particular narrative structure. I mean, it's very, it's interwoven stories is the way I would describe the novel. Seems like a very complicated book to choose to try to adapt.
I wish you had told me that a couple of years ago. That would have been so much help.
No, because then you wouldn't have done it.
Well, and it was part of it. I really walked around for a year thinking, how could I do this? And how can I honor the way it's written, but make it theatrical as well?
Right, right.
Dybek's not linear, and so I wanted to figure out a way how to write it in a way that felt like memory, which isn't linear either. Mm-hmm. If you walk beside Lake Michigan, if you're like me, you immediately have hundreds probably of memories of being by Lake Michigan, and they're not in order.
Right.
So to me, trying to figure out how to fit that around the whole Dybek thing, the whole Chicago scene, was part of the excitement. If it had been really simple, I suppose I wouldn't have been as challenged by it.
Uh-huh.
I'm an old broad, and it was an exciting new challenge for me.
Right.
If it had been too straightforward, I probably wouldn't have been as interested, but maybe saner at this point.
Well, what are the differences between a novel and a play that create the most challenges, that present the most challenges for ending up with something that is theatrical as you do an adaptation?
Well, I think trying to be true to his internal monologues, internal dialogues, and put that on stage in a way that didn't seem stagey, that seemed honest, mm-hmm. was very tricky. But I always really loved to have to create characters, and so to me that was what drew me, and that's what I could be truest to as long as I kept coming back to the characters. But I also had to make choices. If you're going to be totally true to it, it's going to be 10 hours long.
Right.
And so that was also a very hard thing because there's so much in it. There was a point where my director kept urging me to go back to the book during rehearsals, and I said, you know, I just can't at this point, because I'll keep picking up a page and going, oh, why didn't I fit that in?
Right, right.
So some of it's just making choices, making theatrical choices, occasionally changing something to make it more visual, to make it more theatrical, something that he could explain in a narrative way in the book that I had to do visually for people. But then that's part of the excitement, is that sometimes you can just give somebody a flash of a costume and they know something that it might take Stuart two pages to describe. So that's a real plus to it. And, you know, rather than just seeing it as a terrifying either or, it was fun to see what I could do painting a picture on stage that he was doing with words.
Maybe you could give an example of how you take, you know, a long passage that's rumination inside the character's mind and very subjective, and how you translate it into the objective world of a stage play.
Well, I think that there are moments, especially involving his, there's a boy, it's mostly about this boy's travels through the world of Little Village, Perry, and how he becomes a writer, and all the different characters, and one of the characters, Uncle Lefty, is very important to him. He's sort of the tragic, arty character in his life versus the very stolid working class father that he has. And so even just a moment of seeing Lefty on stage humming Fly Me to the Moon, pretending to be playing a vacuum cleaner attachment, being able to actually hear that and see that. I loved picturing that when I read the book, but it's really wonderful to see Lance Baker doing it on stage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you don't need the description, you just need to see the look on his face and hear the mimicry.
Well, maybe that leads to a broader question, is what do you lose and then what do you gain by dramatizing a novel like this?
Well, for one thing, I didn't want a narrator. I thought that that was cheating. I really wanted people to leap in. There are images of people leaping into the lake, and I wanted the audience to leap into this story and into this neighborhood. And so, you know, I suppose there are some internal things that get lost doing it that way, because I can't tell you what people are thinking.
Right.
But to me, theater is supposed to be about showing rather than telling, and so to me, being able to really narrow it down and pick the bits out of the stories. But there's always going to be some richness to the stories that I'm going to have to throw away.
Mm-hmm. So going to this play is not a substitute for reading the novel.
No,
it's just
think hopefully the two go together, and I hope it seems like people so far are responding and liking both.
Uh-huh.
And feeling like I distilled it in a way that didn't cheat it. But I'm sure there are going to be people who go, but she didn't put in,
right,
or she changed this. Or,
well, is there one principle that you use when you're deciding what to keep and what to throw out?
Well, I think with any play, you have to figure out what moves the play along.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, because it's such a mosaic rather than a linear structure, that's been very tricky to figure out which thread to keep in and which not to. But I think just whatever seemed truest to the story, you always have to honor your characters and you have to believe that they would do things. And so even the couple of places where, for dramatic reasons, I changed the story because I couldn't do it the way that Stuart had written it in the book, because you really would have to read the whole thing to get it.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't understand it on stage without getting into Stuart's head.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what I changed it to, I hope people seem to believe. I want people to walk out,
right,
feeling like they believe in all these characters.
So you're saying you might change the story just because you have to have a kind of shorthand, and a more complex inner story just isn't going to be understandable on stage. Is that right?
That's probably a good way of shorthanding me.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, another thing I'm interested in, to me, that choice not to have a narrator is a very significant one, because the entire book is that's not quite true, but a lot of the book is within the consciousness of this one first boy and then older person, Perry. So when you are sitting in a theater and all the characters essentially are equal, I mean, you're not in the head of any of them anymore, What does that change about the meaning of anything that happens in the book or the way you tell it?
I think the way we're doing it and the strength of the acting and the strength of the directing, I think you're still pointed in the direction of that it's Perry's story, that he's the central person, that this is all a rich neighborhood that he's pulling stories from that he'll end up using in his life as a writer. So I think it keeps pulling back whether Perry's played by the young boy or by the teenage actor. Mm-hmm. I think you still come back to that it's his, that he's the central driving star.
And is that as simple as that he has the most lines and is, you know, in every scene? Is that what it is?
Keep going, Perry, Perry. Every so often he'll be watching a little bit of a scene or there'll be a handoff or something. But, uh-huh. but there's certainly moments where he may not even be in the scene. It's just the life of the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But I think he's so woven into the life of that neighborhood and then starts drawing back a little bit as the artist has to. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that process without me going John Boy Walton and having him have a pad in hand.
Right, right, right.
Be commenting.
Right.
But I just thought, you know, and there's certainly been brilliant plays with narrators, some of the great plays, something like Glass Menagerie as a narrator.
Right.
So it's not like I don't think they can work.
Right.
But in this particular case, I just didn't want any distance between the audience and all these characters. I wanted them to feel like it was their world as well as his.
Well, and I've had the experience in a play that's narrated that it almost seems like a cop-out. Like, if you're going to give me a play, give me stuff on stage. I can, you know, read these words. Give me something to see. So I personally really respect that choice just as inherently very theatrical. Obviously, you can have narrators and it can be great, but it seems like this is, in a way, the harder way to go and maybe ultimately the more theatrical.
Well, and even choosing to do as many of the stories as I humanly could rather than choosing three was mm-hmm. a hard choice, but I just thought it was such a rich world I didn't want to short any mm-hmm, of them. Mm-hmm. But sure, there's times where I can remember seeing, there was an Edith Wharton movie, Age of Innocence, and I love that book. I love Edith Wharton. But they had a narrator, and I just thought, you just couldn't stand to not have her language in this, but you sure took me out of the movie by doing
right,
it that way.
Right. If you're going to make a movie, make a movie.
Right. I think that's what Edith would have wanted.
Right, 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 right. Well, let me ask you, has the author of the book, Stuart Dybeck, been involved at all in this adaptation process?
He specifically wanted to just give us a lot of rope. Mm-hmm. And he just thinks that it's a process that's all unto itself and that he doesn't necessarily understand it. He loves theater, but he's just made supportive murmurings and uh-huh. come to a couple of read-throughs and had some comments, which some of them I've used, some of them I haven't, and we've just, you know, we've stayed in touch, and he'll be here for a couple of the previews at least to give us his thoughts. Mm-hmm. But he's wanted it to have a life of its own. And that's a tricky thing. I mean, that's a very generous thing to let go and let us do our job and then to let it be. Because he understands that there are two separate things, the novel and this play.
Right. I could imagine that there would be two levels of places where an author might have difficulty. And one is just understanding that the technique of dramatic writing is just very different from novel writing. And there, I could imagine that you just make the leap of faith, well, Claudie's the playwright, she knows plays, I can let go. But there's something else I imagine, which is that you're refracting his characters. And in fact, I believe you've had to write dialogue for them a lot to fill in things that might otherwise be narrative. And I could imagine...
Well, a lot of the dialogue is mine, and hopefully... One of my big aims was that you couldn't tell the difference.
Right.
Because there are specific lines that are his that I did pull from the book. But and when we did our little preview thing at the beginning of the theater season and I actually read a couple pages from it, I had people saying, oh, isn't it weird to be reading somebody else's stuff? And I said, well, actually, that was almost all me.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So that's been an important part to me. So that hopefully it sounds like Dybeck to Dybeck,
too. It all fits,
too.
Right. Well, and I guess that's what I was getting at, is that he would accept everything you did. I could imagine him throwing his hands up and saying, no, 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 Perry would never say that, and how you might deal with that. But you're saying that really didn't happen. That
well, and I hope that if that's coming, that it comes up soon before we open.
Right.
But so far, no. I think the very first draft, he was a little concerned that it wasn't funny enough, but he didn't until he heard it, and then
right.
he realized that it was. Because
right.
I think most people, even brilliant writers like Stuart, can't always read plays.
Right, right.
It's a different skill to read a play.
That's exactly right.
And that's, I'm very much indebted to actors for bringing my words alive. And as soon as we read even the first draft, which was skeletal, it obviously, the life of the character was starting to
come
through.
Right?
And it was funny. Even when I'm tragic, I'm funny. So.
Well, and the book is certainly very funny, so that's only right.
Well, and I did want it to be full of life and grit, and when we had our initial conversation, I said that I want to be true to this book. I don't want it to just go all one way, all sentimental, all funny, all, because there's a whole lot of life in there, and there's some very gritty, brutal things in there,
right,
too, and I wanted to honor that that's part of the neighborhood. That was part of growing up where he did.
I can imagine some of those gritty elements that you're talking about feel very different when you read something and then when you're confronted by them on stage. Do you think that's true?
Well, you always have to be careful on stage. There's that old story about Oklahoma where when they kill off Judd.
Poor Judd.
Yeah, poor Judd is dead. You have to really be careful or the audience laughs.
Uh-huh.
And that was always a big concern of mine. In fact, there's a murder in this show that I had originally talked about switching to a gun rather than a knifing, because I was worried that the knifing would be that people would titter nervously in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's being done realistically enough that I'll be interested in seeing, but I think that people are going to sit back nervously.
But that's so interesting. Why would a gun, as you were imagining it, be less likely to create that problem of nervous laughter?
Well, I think just because we could have gone to a very quick blackout and there wouldn't have been any dealing with the gore aspect.
I see.
He does get gutted in the car and leans forward and the horn goes off and he leans back and there's a visual of blood on the windshield. And it's a fairly graphic. We ended up going ahead and taking our time with it because it is one of the showpieces in that neighborhood that this murder supposedly happened.
Right. Well, and it, I guess what I'm thinking about is that when you read a novel, you can choose how much to see in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can soft pedal it to yourself if you want to. And so there's something very risky, I guess, more risky about when it's on stage and I've got to see what you show me. Is that something that you think about consciously, or you've seen it in your head already when you read the book, so it doesn't seem that different to you?
Well, and I think that so much of, at this point, the director and the actors are making a lot of those choices. Mm-hmm. I'm going along with them or having my own input, but they're finding ways to do that.
Right.
That it's the way I saw it, but it's some of it's not the way I saw it, but it works wonderfully.
Right, and the playwright.
That's the whole collaborative process. We're using some visuals on the back door, some projections that I hadn't seen at all, and generally I'm kind of one who poo-poos using movies in the midst of the theater.
Uh-huh.
I think you should have the theater. There's a lot of people speaking.
Right.
But it actually works really wonderfully to have these projections. It's a way of really opening up and showing bits of the city that you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
Right.
For instance, there's footage of people who grew up in Chicago and knew the Chicken Man, who was mentioned in the book, but there really was a Chicken Man, and you would see him on Maxwell Street, and he would do his bit with his live chicken. And there's some archival footage that we're using as part of the show.
No
kidding.
So
that you can have a little bit of the Chicken Man appear.
Oh, that's so great. That's wonderful to hear.
So there's a lot of slices of Chicago life that you can use. But that hadn't been part of my original vision to have. I had thought we'd just have a regular guy, but instead we have the authentic Chicken Man.
Well, and that brings up your relationship with the director, Sandy Schinner, who's someone you've worked with for a very long time.
Many, many years. Uh-huh. Many wonderful years.
And I imagine that when you're working with someone you know that well and you trust that deeply, it's easier to just let go and let the director add her element.
Well, and that's why there's always a debate with playwrights about whether you should always be working with new directors as an exciting new challenge to yourself, or whether you should work with somebody you've worked with before. And I can see both sides, but there's just nothing like working with somebody that you do totally trust, and you don't have to do the little dance before you start. You can start out right in the middle of things and just leap in. And I insist this was the person that I had to have direct this, because it is such a big, complicated show that I had to have somebody that I both trusted and knew had the talent and the vision to pull it off.
Right. And has she been involved in kibitzing on the actual words that end up in the script?
Oh, she and I always go over that constantly. I mean, and there will still be fine-tuning throughout the preview process where we'll debate whether those two words go in or stay out, or what parts of the... She always has good questions for me. And I always complain, and that's one of the things that's great about working with somebody you feel very safe with, because we have our process, and she knows that my immediate response to a question about a line or a scene will probably be me grumbling and being tragic, and then a minute later or 2 days later, right, I'll in my head listen to what she said and call her and say, you know, you're right about that.
Right, right, right.
But, you know, she has to be willing to put up with me grumbling, and then I have to trust her enough to really listen.
Right. And she knows that you'll grumble, but eventually listen, which is what really matters.
That's it. She knows me well enough to know that somewhere down the line, and it probably will be two days later, that I'll be mumbling to myself and just finally listen.
So she's been actually more directly involved, it sounds like, in the script than Stuart Dybeck.
Oh, far more. I mean, it's that kind of relationship. She and I, it's been our responsibility to put it on stage.
Well, how did you go about, I mean, I imagine, maybe this is not right, but I imagine that for a play you have to have a stronger narrative drive than you do for a novel. Is that true?
I think both have to have their own strong driving. The better ones do. Mm-hmm. Have to have something driving them along. You have to stay intrigued.
Was that something that you had to fiddle with to make it work on the stage, the narrative arc?
Well, I think that there wasn't a clear narrative arc within these stories. They were all interwoven, but I don't think you had to find the thread, be Perry, and then follow his journey along.
Right.
But even that, I didn't do it in the way that I would normally do something, because it very much isn't linear. There are scenes from the 50s woven together with scenes from the 60s, and so it has its own
logic.
It does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the logic of memory.
So is that just instinctive then? This is going to work because I think it's going to work?
That's what I've been saying for the last year or so. Ever since I wrote the first draft, I just had to keep telling people, this is going to work. This is good.
Right,
this is,
right, right.
Trust
and
me.
How much do you trust yourself? How much did you believe it as you were saying it?
I had some very big crisis moments, but I kept coming back to it. And every time I would hear it, I knew I was right.
Uh-huh.
And thank God for good actors.
Right.
And for Sandy. And Sandy was always supportive, and she knew well enough that my first drafts are always short, and then I keep adding on. I really do start with the skeleton. And with this one, that was the hardest thing, was to figure out what kind of a structure to give it, how to start.
Right.
And so once I had that, I knew that I could fill in, because my strongest point probably is writing good character and good dialogue. And so I knew once I had the structure that I could handle the rest. But you certainly, I think any playwright has those crisis times.
Three in the morning, despair.
Yeah, we're a day before the first preview at this point as we're talking, and this is one of those times where one of the interns came up and told me how much she loved the script, and I said, oh, thank you.
I'm so glad to hear today.
A fresh voice tell me
right.
that today. That
right.
was good to hear.
Right, right. Well, how different is it, or is it, to write dialogue for characters that you didn't invent?
Well, I think it's important for any playwright to be able to put their, to be able to have the characters inhabit them. I've always felt like I really should be able to think in the character's dialogue, whether I created the character or not. So to me, that's always been something that I've enjoyed doing, is trying to let them speak through me. So I think that was probably part of that first year when I didn't write anything, was mm-hmm. just letting them, was just walking around with them.
Getting to know them.
And letting them soak into my skin. There really was an osmosis there where I got to a point where I thought that I could speak in their language. But that's been something that all along I said, catch me if I'm using something that came out in 1972. You know,
right.
make sure I've got the right jargon, that they really would be saying that word. And that's a constant process.
Well, when you write your own plays, your original plays, do you have the experience of meeting a character? That is, are you aware of building a character, or does somebody come to you kind of fully formed the way these characters did because they were created by someone else?
I think they usually come and introduce themselves to
mm-hmm.
me. And then they keep getting fuller as I write them, and I say, it's very schizophrenic being a player.
Yeah.
And I'm not very logical in the way. I usually get very obsessed with something. The first draft I usually write, and it always scares my students how fast I write the first draft, because it's usually in days, just a few days. So I am driven along, and that's how, and I find them in the course of the writing.
Mm-hmm.
they start, you know, I really start writing the dialogue and more of it flows out.
Well, have you had the experience, again, in writing your own characters where they said, oh, no, I'm not going to do that? You had some plot point in mind and they and your characters resist it?
Well, I certainly have had times where I've thought that I knew how it was going to end and it didn't.
Uh-huh.
Where I've thought, oh, that's not what she would do.
Right.
No, she really wouldn't die or marry him or whatever the question may be.
And that would have been so elegant, but she just won't do it.
She just won't do it. I know I wrote a play in the 90s called Deed of Trust, and Sandy Schinner was asking me how many characters were in it. And I said, well, you know, there's six. I thought this other brother was going to come, and he didn't want to.
He never turned up.
And she just thought that was so funny, and she was saying, oh, my, John Logan would never write like that.
Uh-huh.
John
right.
Logan's the fellow that wrote Gladiator and all sorts of things. He's a little more methodical in his writing than I am.
They're obviously different ways to do it. Well, here's a question. When you take on an adaptation, I wonder if you ever think this is replacing something of original of your own, and if there's any feeling about that. I mean, you've obviously put a great deal of time into it.
Well, I did make some sacrifices, I felt like, especially last fall. I kept having to, I've put so much writing and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting that there were things that I was starting to write that I had to put aside because I had to stick with this. And I have another play that I really think I'm going to get that done this summer once this is up. But there are probably some things of mine that have been put on pause. And you never know as a playwright if they're going to come off the pause button.
Right. They could die for lack of
maybe
attention.
Maybe I really needed to write that last fall or it's not going to get written.
Right.
So this
right.
was a pretty big choice to do it.
Right.
But it was an exciting challenge too. It's been way more of a gift than a sacrifice.
Uh-huh. Well, I think the show opens in... how many days?
Well, the first preview is on Friday the 8th, which is tomorrow, as we talk.
Tomorrow, right.
And the official opening is the 18th, but we have many previews in between if people want to catch a lower price preview and hopefully see most of the show as it's going to be. Occasionally a light may not come on at the right time.
Right. And will you do talkbacks? Do you use audience response to rethink anything in general? Is that part of your process?
Well, during the previews, there are always audience cards that they hand around. Mm-hmm. And then there are usually discussions once it's up and running.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little too vulnerable to talk to people in person while we're
right.
in previews. But once it's up... well, I'll do at least the first one, and then probably other people will handle some of the other ones because I'll be in Michigan.
Well, are there, without getting specific feedback from individual people, I imagine you do learn a lot. That's the purpose of previews. What kind of information do you get during the preview period?
Well, I sit out amongst the audience, and I see what they're paying attention to, what they're talking about, what they're laughing at. There's just all sorts of, if they're shifting, if they're mumbling. We occasionally have an older person where you can hear what their questions are because they're saying them very loud.
Right. For better and for worse.
For better or for worse.
Right.
But
right.
I'm always watching everything that's going on stage and in the audience, so I can gauge a lot by the way that the audience is reacting.
So you are taking their pulse, so to speak, even though you're not wanting to hear specific comments necessarily.
Well, and I will hear specific comments, but I get the most by just watching the audience watch it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I love that part of the process of sitting in the audience with the audience watching it. That's the final step.
Right,
so
right.
There's a lot where I just feel like even I can tell a lot from the way they're breathing.
Interesting.
You can soak it up.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you. I know that it was perhaps not the next thing you wanted to do, to sit and talk to me the day before you're first facing your audience, but I really appreciate it, and I think it's been very interesting to get a glimpse of what it looks like from the adapter's point of view. So thanks again, Claudia Allen.
Well, thank you, and I hope everybody comes and sees. We just have such a wonderful cast. I'm just very proud of the show.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Chicago, and welcome to another expectant episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you Chicago's theater news for the week of June 11th, 2007. Tickets for the limited holiday engagement of Phantom of the Opera will be going on sale to the general public on Sunday, June 17th. This is, of course, the infamous version of Phantom that was directed by Harold Prince. It will be returning to Chicago at the Cadillac Palace Theater for a limited 10-week engagement starting on, what other day better than Halloween, Wednesday, October 31st. Ticket sales begin at 10 a.m. this Sunday, June 17th at the Broadway in Chicago box office, or you can get a hold of tickets by calling Ticketmaster. For more information on Phantom of the Opera and how to get tickets for this limited holiday engagement, click on over to my favorite website, theaterinchicago.com. Raven Theatre has announced their silver 25th anniversary season, starting off with a gala event on Saturday, July 31st. Yes, Raven Theatre was founded 25 years ago and has dedicated their seasons to breathing new life into American classics. The shows slated for Raven Theatre's silver season include The Night of the Iguana by Tennessee Williams. This one will be directed by Raven Theatre founder Michael Menendian, and he notes that Raven Theatre is beginning off their 25th anniversary season with the playwright who started it all. As some of you may remember, Raven Theatre's first play was Tennessee Williams' 27 Wagons Full of Cotton. The Night of the Iguana opens on Sunday, October 14th. Following that will be the Chicago premiere of Columbinus by the United States Theatre Project. Columbinus is a theatrical discussion that is more than just a play. It includes many interviews and much research around the school shootings of Columbine. The show opens on Sunday, January 27th. Closing out the season will be Laughter on the 23rd Floor by Neil Simon. That one will also be directed by Michael Menendian. It is, how you would say, a comedy inspired by Neil Simon's early experience working on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. For more information on Raven Theatre's Silver Celebration Gala on July 21st, click on over to Talk Theatre in Chicago's Theatre News section. Some changes are afoot at Eclipse Theatre. They have a new artistic director, Nathaniel Swift, and new managing director, Kevin Scott. Following the changes to the administrative staff will be a bit of a change to its one playwright per season habit. For the 2008 and 2009 season, they will be featuring some playwrights which they had featured in previous seasons. This will be works from playwrights that Eclipse Theatre has already profiled before. It's just now it's spicing it up into their season. Talk Theatre in Chicago would like to congratulate Nathaniel Swift and Kevin Scott. And in a bit of sad news this week, the marquee lights of the theaters in the Loop dimmed this week to honor the passing of one of Chicago's top theater managers, Tony DeSantis. Anthony DeSantis passed away this past Wednesday at the age of 93. He died of natural causes in his home, which was an apartment that he kept behind the Drury Lane Theater, Oak Brook Terrace. Tony DeSantis is well remembered for his Drury Lane Theater chain and for discovering many, and I mean many, of the stars that came out of Chicago. And Talk Theater in Chicago would like to express our deepest condolences. He will be greatly missed. Well, thank you very much for listening to this expectant episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from Anthony and Cleopatra, Act 2, Scene 2. Small to greater matters must give way. Well, I can't thank you enough for listening to this podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
You are listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago Review Podcast. Mr. Spackey, the man who was continuously followed by wolves, by Emily Schwartz, directed by Carolyn Klein, and produced by The Strange Tree Group at Chopin Theater. Review by Tom Williams. Emily Schwartz has a penchant for writing wacky, macabre, and hilarious plays that almost defy description. Her The Dastardly Ficus and Other Comedic Tales of Woe and Misery, and her funeral wedding, The Elven Play, were engagingly provocative works that I enjoyed immensely. She has talent and a fresh voice that allows her to write zany plays filled with sick and dark humor. Her latest, Mr. Spacky, the Man Who Was Continuously Followed by Wolves, is a macabre murder musical that is a tuneful and delightfully inventive summer treat. Mr. Spacky is completely original, with toe-tapping folk music nicely played by a 7-member acoustical band. This is a comic murder mystery musical that thoroughly works to produce many belly laughs. It is clever, unpredictable, and audience-friendly. Its charm and unpretentiousness wins us quickly. The smart, crafty acting that combines over-the-top performances with ditzy, straight-arrow work exudes all the humor in Schwartz's tight script. We meet Jennifer Lyon, a sweet yet ditzy, hapless, frilly-hatted bride-to-be who flees the city to escape a terrible war to marry a rural villager. She never meets her fiancé, as she ends up at her soon-to-be sister-in-law Agatha Dumont's house. The cold-hearted Agatha, played marvelously stiff and straight by Carol Enoch, is a macabre character deliciously demented. Her interaction with the wacky Mr. Spacky, played by Scott Cupper, produced many quality laughs. Cupper is so over the top that he delivers the zany and totally loony Mr. Spacky as one hilarious personality. He really believes that wolves are after him. It seems that Elizabeth has been lured to the village for her money, as she'll never marry because Mr. Spacky will murder her before the ceremony, as he did the 3 previous brides-to-be. Spacky's love for Agatha is his sole motivation. Elizabeth quickly bonds with the ever-so-weird, unsettling daughter of Agatha, Edwina, played by Cara Klein in a hoot of a performance. Edwina and Elizabeth land their bedroom scenes with a nice comic twist on dancing. Klein and Marchand have fine stage chemistry that produces funny physical comedy. Elizabeth's humorously horrible journey features a camp of injured soldiers who sing, dance, and play their way into retelling of Miss Lyon's story. Replete with banjos, mandolins, washboards, and accordions, the musical contains a creative blend of folk-styled songs that help tell the story as well as underscore the tone and meanings of the piece. Composer Emily Schwartz can write terrific tunes as well as a workable comedy. Mr. Spacky is 80 minutes of clever, well-crafted, dark humor that sings well and lands enough laughs to please even the coldest hearts. The device of letting the audience pick the ending, either the dark, unhappy, murderous ending, or the zany, sweet, and happy ending, works to further audience involvement and add another cute twist. On opening night, we witness the unhappy, murderous ending. I'm told there is, indeed, another happy ending. Audiences will vote on the ending at each performance. Mr. Spacky is a gem of a show that is part musical, part murder mystery, and all fun. Director Carolyn Klein has her amazing cast in full comic mode as she quickly paces her show with enough surprises to keep us guessing. The music and singing adds much to make this delightful show zing. Emily Schwartz and the folks at The Strange Tree Group are a talented bunch of way-out artists. They exemplify the energy and zest of young, hungry storefront theater troupes. Keep creating your original art. We do need fresh voices. The summer season is off to a very wacky start. This show receives a highly recommended rating. Mr. Spacky, the Man Who Was Continuously Followed by Wolves, by Emily Schwartz and directed by Carolyn Klein. Produced by the Strange Tree Group at Chopin Theater, located at 1543 West Division Street in Chicago, Illinois. Now through June 23rd. For tickets and more information, please call 773-814-6163.
Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Claudia Allen for giving us the honor of interviewing her this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And of course, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.